Welcome to the Tuesday Brown Bagger program, right here on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Today we tackle a question on many people's minds: peak oil or climate change? Which will impact society first? Are they competing issues, or can they seek the same solutions? For those who don't know, peak oil is the theory that humans have already discovered the major oil and gas fields on Earth. And we've passed the halfway mark of what we can get out easily as cheap energy. Now we face a decline in production just as world demand soars. That demand may be met by dirtier and dirtier production with sources like the Canadian tar sands, bad news for the climate and carbon emissions. Our speaker today, recorded at the Vancouver Public Library on December 11, 2007, is a young designer, Bryn Davidson. In his business and nonprofit ventures, Bryn Davidson covers the range from super energy-efficient new homes through energy-sustainable city design to the big picture of world energy supplies. He's just returned from the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas conference in Houston, Texas. Bryn's slideshow for this speech is available free online at his website, www.dynamiccities.org. Click on the slideshows and presentations buttons to find some of the latest graphs clearly showing the latest info on world energy supplies and consumption. Very useful information at dynamiccities.org. Here is Bryn Davidson speaking on peak oil and climate change, two sides of the same coin or competing crises.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight. Thanks to the library and to the Necessary Voices Society for hosting this event. Now, we had a little bit of an introduction, but I think it's important just to talk about where I came from, because I think how we talk about peak oil and climate change really depends on where we're coming from, but also the audience that we're talking to. So as we said in the beginning, I worked for a while as a mechanical engineer in Alaska. This is the North Star oil module, one of BP's manufactured island that they're creating in the North Slope for pumping oil. We are working to actually cool these modules down in the middle of winter. This was a little strange, and given that I was interested in environmental issues, I went on to study architecture here at UBC, where I focused on green building. Now, you don't work on green buildings for too long before you realize that green buildings alone aren't ever going to be a solution. They need to be part of a larger urban network, and really, you start looking at urban design and the way our streets, our public spaces work with our buildings. Now, of course, the way our cities are laid out depends on how our transportation systems work. And in North America, that's obvious with our dependence on the car. And that all, of course, comes from oil. So there's a sort of a circular route, but they're all connected. After working on peak oil for the last several years, I found that it was difficult and sometimes to actually bring it up in conversation depending on the audience you were talking to. I have a design and planning practice where I'm doing residential design and other projects, and I found working with a young couple who wants a home, it's hard to talk to them about the impending collapse of North American natural gas and how that's going to impact them. So I found, depending on your audience, there's really different ways that you have to talk about this. Now, I've also been working and involved in starting a development corporation. We're looking at doing eco-industrial and other types of projects. And through this, I had the opportunity to converse with CEOs of numerous local businesses, talking about their green building expansion strategies. Now, again, it's one thing to sit amongst your friends and talk about peak oil and how it's going to affect our economy. It's another thing to say to a CEO who's looking to expand their business, okay, you're basically screwed. And I think we've come a long way in sort of understanding the sort of complexity and subtleties of the situation. But a couple of years ago, the only dialogue on peak oil was pretty much, okay, we're all screwed, or the people who said, okay, you're crazy. And this was partly where the Dynamic Cities project came from, because it felt like there was a real niche somewhere in between the sort of peak oil dialogue as was happening on the internet and elsewhere, and then on the other hand you have smart growth and green building and these other types of strategies. I felt like there was something in between that acknowledged some of these massive sort of paradigm shifting events but also was working towards a set of solutions that were professional, that had to do with transforming our society as opposed to just sort of throwing up our hands and saying, that's it. So as part of that, I began working with a group of folks here and then actually publishing presentations online and elsewhere. And it was kind of neat in this way because it started to become part of a global dialogue. There's actually people wrestling with these same issues all around the world. And so I would get emails back from Spain or from China or some other place. And here's one of my slides that was translated. I'm not quite sure what the language is. But it's interesting to see somebody take your work and then feel like it needs to be disseminated. Recently, I traveled down to Houston, Texas for a conference. It was the ASPO USA, which is the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, their annual conference. It's pretty fascinating in part just because of the huge turnout there from people from industries like hedge funds and other big money sort of interests. So I feel like we're at a kind of, whereas climate change is at a sort of critical tipping point in the public conscience, I feel like peak oil is now starting to get the attention of people in the market, the money market sectors and other types of sectors. So it's really gone beyond fringe, and I think this is where we start to have an interesting dialogue. Now, of course, what I've come to talk about is not peak oil or climate change, but energy transition. What I see us doing is actually transitioning away from cheap oil and gas over the next 40 years. And that's going to be a bumpy transition. It's going to be driven by various types of crises that unfold. But I feel like both of these are equally important components of a larger thing that we're involved in. Now, as part of this effort, I've been going around talking to local city councilors and other types of folks about peak oil resolutions and other things like this. And in this process, I found actually that some of the biggest hurdles that were thrown up were actually coming from people in the climate change community. This was interesting to me because I always considered them to be more or less similar issues in terms of the response that was required. But some of the issues that have come out, people thought that peak oil was actually a distraction from climate change. Felt like it was going to steal the spotlight and or muddy the issue. There were some people who said, okay, what's the big deal if we're dealing with climate change? We're also dealing with peak oil, so we don't even need to talk about it. Of course, then there are the people who think it's a conspiracy theory cooked up by big business. I think if you've ever seen the money or time that the CEOs of the major oil companies have put into denying peak oil, I think you would come to see that it's probably not a conspiracy theory put on by big business. And, of course, the economist's standpoint that the market will take care of peak oil, and it's not something that needs to be addressed with policy. Now, vice versa, this is interesting going around, especially going to some place like a peak oil conference or talking to other folks in the business community or elsewhere, because I have run across many who believe in peak oil, think it's a very serious problem, but have no concern whatsoever for climate change. This is always fascinating to me. I'm from Alaska. We're all for global warming. Now, I'd heard this before, but I heard this again recently from a professor from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in Houston, a professor of economics. So it's not by any means rare to come across somebody who still holds this type of opinion. Of course, there are many people who believe that in the next few decades, peak oil, even though it's much less well-known than climate change, I think at the moment, that in terms of its direct impact on people, that it will blow away climate change in terms of fiscal impact, its impact on food systems, health systems, social systems. We can argue about this one, but I think there is certainly, we can talk more about it as we get into it. Again, at the moment, the economy is going along pretty well here, and we can worry about things like polar bears. I think there is a concern that if the economy turns south and you start worrying about things like lights and heating, that all of a sudden concerns for abstractions or remote events might start to slip away. And of course, there's the issue with timing. I believe that there are climate change impacts happening now and that they are immediate and at hand. But there is a general perception that the climate impacts are something that's somewhere off far in the distance, whereas when you look at the price of gas or the price of oil, this is something that's immediate. So peak oil versus climate change, starting point for this conversation. I see peak oil, it's a crisis of capitalism and economic growth. I think we could function in a world with declining oil reserves, but I don't know that a capitalist system, as it's currently set up, can really function that well where you don't have growing oil supplies. And I think this is going to be one of the major challenges, is figuring out going forward, how do we deal with that issue? Now, of course, the economic problem has the potential to translate into humanitarian and other types of social issues, but of course the scale is a little bit, it's undetermined, or a little hard to tell exactly. This is the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Interesting, because the Wall Street Journal would be actually putting this type of thing on their front page, where they're saying, okay, there are real limits to oil production. This is, it may not seem like it, but potentially a sort of watershed event in terms of the acceptability of talking about this issue publicly. Now, another major kind of issue with peak oil is that it's primarily manifest as a sort of social justice issue, the fact that this is going to hit the poor much more directly than the rich. In this article, they're saying low-income folks are actually feeling 8 times the impact versus what higher-income folks are feeling. So we're looking at, as prices change, as we go through this energy transition, there are sectors of our society that are much more vulnerable than others. And of course, then there's the issue of food. Oil and fossil fuels are directly tied into the way we produce food, distribute it, and everything. And we're already seeing those types of impacts happen in the third world and other places where food is becoming a serious issue. This recent cover of The Economist, the end of cheap food. People have been talking about the end of cheap oil. The concern now is, does this mean the end of cheap food? So now climate change, of course climate change, it's a global humanitarian and ecological crisis that has the ability to translate into economic crises. The problem is that many of the issues, they're delayed, diffuse, or diverse impacts. So it's hard to exactly pin down climate change with this caused this exactly in the way that high gas prices, say, causes inflation or something like that. Typical article talking about climate change. We're facing immediate threats, but there's also long-term risks about big problems like the collapse. But we always have to say may. This may happen, this may not. There's always a degree of uncertainty about talking about the impacts of these. And then also the fact that, okay, it's in Cambodia. These things are happening, at least immediately, in places that are far away. How many folks here have read George Monbiot's book, Heat? I got a handful. In that, he proposes fairly stringent climate targets. And he says, basically, to reach my targets, we'd have to pretty much have a ban on jet travel. So the question is now, when we look at the risks of climate change versus having to impose on ourselves a set of limits, the question is, are we actually going to be willing to impose the necessary limits on ourselves? And I think this is where the intersection with peak oil starts to become interesting. If we could absolutely prevent an acceleration of global climate change, how many of you would vote today for a complete ban on jet travel? And how many of you think that, if put to a vote in the general public, that would pass? So there are fairly massive things that need to be done if we are to get to that level of emission reduction that's probably actually necessary. The question is whether we as a Western democracy are even capable of inflicting that level of change on ourselves is a question that I'd like to ask. I think I'd probably argue that peak oil in many ways will end up driving a lot of this discussion, but that it's very critical that we figure out how to go through this transition basing our decisions on climate change. Okay, so now another issue is many of the potential responses to climate change do nothing to reduce the oil dependence of our economy. And this is a major issue. You're looking at something like forestry-based emissions offsets. People are talking about planting trees to reduce emissions. They're also talking about trading emissions, so somebody else's emissions over here for what we do over here. None of those activities reduce the oil dependence of your local economy. So, okay, if our entire climate change strategy is based on planting trees, okay, we might get completely obliterated by peak oil. So I think when we start looking at what are the best solutions, we need to start thinking about, okay, it's fine. Planting trees could be great, but we need to start reducing our actual consumption of oil and gas. Again, when we start looking at adaptive strategies for climate change, we need to figure out, can they also reduce the oil dependence of our economy? Same thing on the climate, on the peak oil side. There are many folks in the peak oil dialogue who are saying we need to scale up every possible source of liquid fuel that we can because we're facing a major crisis. Now, that's fine if you're not concerned about climate change, but if you are, things like coal to liquids or scaling up unsustainable biofuels or the tar sands are actually disasters. These things are disasters in the making. So I think what we're going to see is with peak oil, a real drive from certain sectors of the economy to scale these things up as fast as possible. And we'll get more into that later, but I think this is very problematic and one of the major challenges that we're facing. So as I see it, I've come to talk about it, that climate change I really see as the goal. This is the long-term strategy. This is the thing that ultimately is probably the most important. But I feel like peak oil will really actually define the rules of the game, the economics of how we get from here to there. And so to talk about climate change without understanding peak oil, I think it's just a very difficult situation. And I've shown here, then I think what's in the middle is actually the smart moves to make are the ones that are at the intersection between those two issues. And in working through the Dynamic Cities Project, we've been trying to figure out how do we even talk about these, how do we begin to bundle these into a way that then can be communicated. And so there are many things that I think that are in common between the two. You know, they're pretty familiar, energy efficiency and whatnot, scaling up low-carbon energy sources, other things like this. Those are all familiar. The question is, how do we get from here to there? The name Dynamic Cities Projects comes out of the fact that I believe the important thing is the dynamics of the transition. How do we get from where we are today to where we'll be in 40 years in the future? All of us could easily live and be quite happy with half the energy that we're using today. But if that was to happen tomorrow, it'd be chaos. So the question is not just can it be done, but how do you get from here to there and how quickly does it happen? So in coming to talk about it, I like to use sporting analogies just because that's what I know. People say, how do you talk about gloom and doom issues? And I think, okay, well, as an analogy, when I was learning to whitewater kayak, my friend who was teaching me, he says, the first thing you do when you get up to the rapid is you get out of your boat, you walk up the side of the river, and you look, and you see if there's any logs or big scary rocks or whatever. Because you want to know what's coming up ahead of you. You know, you don't want to go into this stuff blind because you're right in the middle of it. Once you've scoped out the terrain, then you come back, you get in your boat, and you look right where you want to go. You don't look at the thing that you're afraid of. You look right where you want to go, and then you paddle like hell. And I think this is the important thing to do, is to talk about the fact that there are two aspects of talking about this issue. One is looking at potential scenarios about the future, discussing frankly the real risk associated. If you're talking about collapse of an economy or collapse of a local ecosystem, we need to talk about those failure modes and how they can unfold. But then you got to rewind and say, okay, today we need a positive vision, proactive for what we can do, and we need to do it all pulling in the same direction. So for this, the latter part of this, or the middle and latter part of this presentation, I want to talk a little bit about scenario gaming, how it is that through scenarios we can come to understand the way all of these different things interact with each other. Then talk about modeling the energy transition, looking at peak oil climate change. How does that actually unfold? This is new work, so you're the first people to see any of this. So it's still perhaps in a rough stage, but I think it's interesting enough that I wanted to share it with you. And then, of course, how do we make the smart moves? I've been giving these peak oil presentations for a number of years, and I still run into a lot of folks who have never even heard of it. I think in Vancouver, we're probably a little different than most other cities. Now, peak oil, when you pump oil, you have to find it. There's a sort of a curve of you find a bunch of the oil, and then a little while later, you produce the oil. And that oil goes through a production curve, and at some point, you reach a peak. And there's some sort of time lag. In the beginning, the oil is nice and easy. It comes out of the ground. It shoots up. Later on, it's dirty. It's thick. It's nasty. I think the fact that we're trying to wring tar out of sand gives me some indication that the oil, nice, the nice, cheap, easy oil is gone. We see this discovery production curve. We see that on a country by country basis. Again, in the UK, discovery production, discovery production, discovery production. And today, many of the countries that produce oil are actually past the peak and in terminal decline. Here's sticking up all those countries that are in decline together. The important thing that we start to notice is looking minus 3%. The question is, how quickly do we fall off that back slope? And I think this really becomes one of the critical issues in this discussion. Globally, many people have seen this graph. Discovery in the bars, discovery, and again, production, suggesting that we have some way of looking forward to saying, okay, we're probably going to go into decline. Question is when and how quickly. Not as many people have seen this one. This is North American natural gas. This is discovery and production. When you start to look at the way these two correlate to each other, you look at that big drop in discovery and say, well, that's probably potentially scary. So the question is, what are we facing in terms of North American natural gas? And this actually starts to translate into one of the major issues in intersecting with climate change. Because whereas during the 90s we were powering all of our electricity, our new power stations with natural gas, our emissions were actually reducing in intensity. But now what we find is that coal is back, and coal is back in a big way, not just here but globally. So what's happened is actually our emissions were increasing at a certain rate till around 2000, and then they've actually been ramping up since then. So a lot of our early discussion about climate change was talking about our emissions ramping at this rate, but since then with the massive uptake of coal, we were actually seeing an increase. So when we start to look at this, we actually see that, okay, oil and natural gas, many of us think of them as perhaps bad things, but they're actually relatively nice, clean fuels compared to some of the things that we're bringing on as substitutes. So this then becomes what the real race. The question is, how fast does depletion happen versus how quickly we can respond? Couple example, these are oil fields, major oil fields that have gone through that peaking and decline. In Russia, Texas, Russia again, and Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. So those oil fields I was working on the North Slope, we're adding new oil. They were adding new oil, but it's definitely still on the decline side, the downslope of that production curve. If you add up all the major oil fields in the world, you can kind of then project forward what you think the decline rate for the world might be. This is a fellow who did a study, I think it was a doctoral thesis project, looking at major oil fields and creating scenarios for how quickly that depletion could happen. Now then the question is, okay, how quickly can we actually, as a society, respond to this type of event? As an example, this is a graph. It's a little hard to see. It's from Australia. At a certain point, they changed the rules saying you can't drive with leaded gasoline anymore. They said, from this point on, you've got to use unleaded gasoline. Okay, so they changed the rule. But it takes 15 years, basically, for the fleet to change over, for people to buy new cars that can run on unleaded gasoline. So what you have is then a mitigation wedge. And any solution that we talk about is going to come on board as a wedge, basically, meaning that it can only scale up so quickly. Okay, we could, if we covered the Sahara Desert in solar panels, we could have a ton of energy. Well, the question is, how quickly could that happen? If you want tar sands to give you oil, how quickly can that happen? Any of these solutions manifest itself as a wedge like this. And I think this is one of the really important things to talk about. I don't care how many reserves you have somewhere. The question is production and how quickly that can scale up. Now, of course, when you're talking about demand-side stuff, changing the city takes even longer. It's one thing to change over a fleet of cars, but our cities, our homes, these are things that last for a long time. And so it may be that our oil-dependent infrastructure and cities that we have today are going to be with us for a long time. Again, not a very lovely graph, but this came out of a report to Congress, the U.S. Congress, last year, where they were looking at the strategic implications of fuels. And so they were looking at how quickly can we scale up efficiency, how quickly can we scale up alternative liquid fuels. And here they're talking, again, those things, oil shale, coal liquids, heavy oil. The thing that's fascinating about this graph is that they show their baseline oil production as being flat. Frankly, I think this is pure delusion. I think the point of the report was they were trying to show that they could actually reduce dependence on foreign oil. So they make these bizarre assumptions. But you'll see this in many places and from many official agencies where there's no acknowledgement of oil depletion. And so I think many of the conclusions that come out of these mainstream reports are completely spurious. Again, a couple of years ago, a very important study came out. People call it the Hirsch Report. This was a fellow who was looking at peak oil in a study for the Department of Energy. And he said basically, these alternatives to oil can scale up so quickly. And so they stack up all these wedges. And he says, okay, if we wanted to mitigate peak oil, we'd need to start 20 years in advance and go like hell. So the question then is, if we don't do it 20 years in advance, what does that mean? And it manifests as supply shortfalls and all sorts of other problematic issues. And I think this is probably most likely what we're really going to see. The motivation will come in the form of price shocks or whatever, and then the action will come. I really doubt that we're going to seriously try and mitigate peak oil or climate change 20 years in advance. So now I want to go back and talk for a sec about that issue of energy justice. If, for instance, this is our depletion curve, then this is how it actually would probably manifest in different places in the world. I think what we find is that poor countries are experiencing peak oil now, and we'll see it happen faster. Rich countries will see that delayed, and so we'll get a spread. We'll also see the same distribution happen locally. And this becomes one of the real things where peak oil translates into a social justice issue. The fact that the poor or the certain vulnerable populations are actually much more vulnerable to changes in the price of energy. So while for you or I it might be one latte less a day, for somebody else it might mean that they can't afford to go to their job or pay for food or whatever else. So I think this is one of the really important issues, is we'll see a real social stratification come about from the market-based responses to rising oil prices. Now, of course, I don't think any one of those scenarios is exactly what's going to happen, but I think it might be some mix. So this is an attempt to kind of map out how those things might start out with, starting with, you know, the city that we have today, moving forward, some sort of crisis from dealing with peak oil, and then eventually over time we're able to scale up the responses, both the lean and local responses and the techno markets responses. I want to dig into some numbers. Many people talking about climate change and peak oil say we need to do a lot. It could happen sometime between now and the future, but I think it's important that at some point we need to sort of draw a line in the sand and say this is what I think is going to happen. We need to say it's basically like a battlefield decision. We have imperfect information, but we need to make a decision. So this next section is my attempt at wrestling with some actual numbers and seeing how that plays out. Again, another sporting analogy, lessons learned from climbing. Some of these things are big and scary. I think many of these, the idea of the energy transition is big and scary. First thing is to get a decent map so you can have an idea of where to go and know when you're off course. Once you have that map in place, the first steps are surprisingly familiar. So I think that it's important that we begin to understand the energy transition as a whole, so that today when you replace that compact fluorescent light bulb by a Prius or whatever else, you understand that it's the first step amongst something that is much larger. And that it doesn't stop with those just little steps, but we actually have to get into the real nuts and bolts of changing our economic system, our infrastructure, all of these things. So what we're trying to do here for the next few slides is create this sort of map that talks about the next 40 years, so we can start to internalize and visualize what some of those changes might be. So missions. I know I've been kind of talking a lot about peak oil. I feel like to a certain extent, climate change is pretty much in the public consciousness right now. So I often will dwell more on peak oil.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to Peak Oil and Climate Change, Two Sides of the Same Coin or Competing Crises by Bryn Davidson. It was recorded in Vancouver, Canada on December 11, 2007.
But in terms of emissions, consensus, if we wanted to keep it below 2 degrees temperature rise above pre-industrial temperatures, let's say we want to reduce emissions 40 to 60% below where we are. Now, some people say, forget it, that's way too much. Some people say, forget it, that's way too little. I'm going to say this, let's start here and talk about how that would unfold. So there we are globally, aiming for a 50% reduction, I'm going to say, by 2050. We're looking at how different that is from business as usual. The question is, what should we be doing in this room, in our city, to contribute to that overall emission reduction? So what we have here, developed this mapping. On one axis, we have CO2 per capita, how much we're emitting, and then GDP per capita. So there we are. We're amongst the cluster of the richest people in the world, and we also emit amongst the most CO2 in the world. So I'm going to make the argument that the people at that end of the graph probably have more responsibility to reduce their emissions than the people at this end. So China, they're down there, big bubble, they emit a ton, but on a per capita basis, they're way lower. So I think to put the onus completely on them, I just don't think it's going to happen. So for the sake of argument, I'm going to break these guys up into four tiers and then say, okay, if we want to get to an average of 50%, China and some of these other countries are going to actually grow their emissions and be flat for a little while before declining. That means that us in the wealthier world need to actually be more aggressive. So to get to that 50%, I think that we actually need to be significantly more aggressive in the U.S. and Canada. There's on a per capita basis some idea of convergence saying, okay, let's aim towards everybody having an equal share of an allowable carbon emission. Now again, even within Canada, I think that it's fair to ask that the major cities, I think they both have the capacity and the ability to reduce their emissions more than some of our rural cities and suburban cities. So I'm going to make the argument that whereas Canada on average is there in the middle, that our seven largest cities, these are actually the emissions targets that they should be taking on if they want to see that 50% by 2050 global cut. Now, a few things. I've created what I think to be a realistic peak oil model for the U.S. and Canada. These are just one of the many sort of assumptions that go into that. Much of the data that's out there that's public is political data. We see here OPEC reserves jumped up. In the mid-80s, they changed the rules. The more reserves you had, the more oil you were allowed to pump. So overnight, wow, we've got more reserves. And we see that, of course, reflected in all the reported data for how much our global oil reserves are. There are a number of groups these days starting to do these projections now. You can see the dashed lines are the International Energy Agency. They're looking at the paper barrels and they're making these forecasts. These other groups are looking at actual production rates and they're making different forecasts. I have a tendency to believe the people that acknowledge peak oil. I'm obviously a little bit biased, but I think that there's a lot of argument to be had for believing in that. Okay, another thing recently, this is the conference I attended. There was a speaker who was asked, when do you think we're going to peak? Because, of course, this is the question on everybody's mind. He says, it's easy. We've already peaked. 85 million barrels a day, that's as high as we're going to go. And this is a fellow named T. Boone Pickens. Everybody in the room takes him seriously because he's a billionaire. So this is the fascinating thing where certain people within the money industries or in the oil industries are taking this seriously and saying, we're pretty much at peak oil right now. We're not going to be able to prepare for this 20 years in advance. This is the actual data for production, and as far as we can tell, it looks like we did peak in fall of 2005. It's possible that we might go back up again, but it's also possible that this is what you're looking at there is global peak oil. Another interesting phenomena, you have the oil exporting countries, and in their own country, they subsidize the price of oil. So gasoline is cheap in Venezuela or in Saudi Arabia or wherever. So what you're seeing is actually in Indonesia, these other exporting countries, their oil consumption is going like this. It's going like crazy because they have subsidized oil. Meanwhile, their production is flat or declining or growing slowly. You subtract those two, and what it means is that there's less oil to be exported onto the world oil market. So what we're seeing is, in North America maybe, what we're actually concerned is about peak oil exports. And this is the real data for exports from the top 16 exporters. Again, peaked around the fall of 2005 and in decline. So this is my model. Again, going back to the study that was done, the thesis, and taking into account some of these other factors. And the fact that the U.S. and Canada is a rich country, I'm going to put them right in the middle and say this is my model for oil depletion for the U.S. and Canada. I think we're going to be at a plateau until 2010. I don't think we're going to see much above where we are today. Declining at 2% to 2015 and then 4% annually from there on. So in terms of modeling this, I started to get into, okay, what real component can energy efficiency contribute to this overall discussion? People, there's videos like The End of Suburbia and some of these other issues, James Kunstler and some of these other authors talking about the collapse of suburbia. And I kind of wanted to model this a little bit and just see what might happen. So to start off with, looking at fuel economy for cars, here we are today, about 21 miles per gallon on average. Sorry, I have it in the U.S. standards. If we raised the efficiency of new cars by increments, this is what they're looking at in Congress now, raising the fuel standards, there's then a time lag between what then the fleet, the efficiency of the overall fleet, such that in 2040, I think it's pretty reasonable to say we could probably get to an average fuel economy of 35 miles a gallon. That's what a Honda Fit is today, which, by the way, is a great car, if anybody. It also happens to be about where Europe is now in terms of their fuel economy. So I don't think this is an unreasonable assumption in terms of how we can change the efficiency of our fleet. Trucks and jets, it's a little bit different story. There's less potential for improved efficiency. These things also get changed over much slower. So, okay, we might have super fuel-efficient jets coming on board, but in 2040, most of the jets flying around will have been built today. So even though new technology comes on board, it doesn't necessarily instantly translate into an overall efficiency improvement. So again, looking at, we're literally stuck up a cul-de-sac in a cement SUV without a fill-up. Jim Kunstler, let's look at cars. This is in a peak oil scenario using that model. Business as usual. There's gasoline. Now we're adding tar sands and coal liquids. Those are scaling up. Again, one of those wedges. CO2 neutral biofuels. Then there's a vehicle fuel efficiency using that model that I just showed you. It actually adds up to a pretty big chunk, and I think part of that is the fact that our cars are just so terribly inefficient now. We have actually a lot of room to work with. And then scaling up electric cars. And what's left over is what we need to change in terms of our demand. So looking at this, I don't think that cars are really the issue in terms of peak oil. It may be that we do see the end of suburbia, but I think it might manifest from other directions. We are so hugely inefficient in the way we use our cars and everything that I don't think that that type of change is going to be too catastrophic to bring about. What we look at now is then emissions. The dashed blue line is the emissions target. There's our emissions from oil. And then what we have is our emissions from tar sands and coal liquids. Now this is where the real problem is that We can bring on substitute liquids, but these generally have an emissions that's around double what we're currently burning for oil and gas. So we bring on a little bit of extra liquids. It helps maybe the economy or whatever else. But 2040, we're only down 30% on our emissions. So I think this is really sort of one of the crux issues we're dealing with, is our desire to have liquid fuel on one hand and then our desire to reduce our emissions. So around 2025, I'd say maybe peak carpool, we could call that. Might be able to get that out of land use, but say 20% of driving gets shifted. So CO2 constraint scenario, if we were to actually hit that carbon target, oil rationed by CO2 limits, very little tar sands and coal liquids, more biofuels, efficiency, electric cars. That's the difference between business as usual. And so we say, okay, this is the sort of what I see as the range of possible futures in terms of how we're going to be using cars. It could be that in 2040, 60% of today's trips actually need to be shifted to something else. On a per capita basis, me as an individual, there's a good chance that in 2040, if I'm still around, I'll be driving 50% less than I'm driving around today. So now goods movement, this becomes, I think, maybe a much more critical issue than the cars issue. We look at trucks. Again, oil, tar sands, biofuels, fuel efficiency. We can potentially shift some of our freight onto electric rail. I think electric rail is going to become an important aspect of the way we move goods in the future. But again, it only scales up at a certain rate, and we've got a long way to go in terms of rebuilding that infrastructure. What's left is demand reduction. The red line, I would say that this is how much road capacity we need for trucks. So from looking at that, I'd say we have about as much road capacity today for trucks as we ever need. And I think this starts to be, when we're planning our cities, becomes one of the really important things, is to start saying, okay, we're looking at parking, we're looking at road capacity. We probably have as much today as we ever need. Under climate change scenario, that's the road capacity that we need for trucks. Now, climate change scenario, this is the total demand reduction. This says these are the products that we're getting from the global economy today that we can't get in the future. And so the question is, okay, some of those we can switch to local products that are already in existence. We can scale up local production. People can start manufacturing things locally. The difference is the things that you basically do without. So, of course, this is a pretty aggressive scenario looking at that climate change target. And these numbers down here, the curves, they could be adjusted all over the place. But I want to talk about how these react with each other and saying, okay, 2030, I call it peak austerity. Basically, the fact that we're going through decline in emissions or production while our solutions are scaling up, which means that we're going to go through a transition time now till 2030 or wherever, where we're going to go through some real challenges. And I think that's our challenge, is to deal with that in a way that doesn't destroy the climate. Again, here's looking at jet travel, efficiency and everything factored in. 2040, probably flying 60% less than we're flying today on a per capita basis. So we can talk about how that impacts our families, our way we send goods, everything else. It also says probably investing in expanded airports isn't the best way to spend your money. A lot of talk recently about aging infrastructure, and I think when we look about the end of suburbia, that it's really the infrastructure that's going to end up driving a lot of these changes more than the fact that we don't have gasoline for our cars. And I think this is going to be one of the real sort of perfect storm issues that we're going to see, you know, coming into the coming decades. Most of our infrastructure is old and it needs replacement. I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here. I haven't seen many studies, but I'm going to say this is my scenario. I'm going to say that there's some correlation between asphalt and oil production. We can probably get some tar sands, you know, asphalt from tar sands and other things, and better efficiency. I'm going to say, in this scenario, in 2040, Our ability to build and maintain roads is 40% less than what it is today, just because of the cost of obtaining bitumen and all the other things that you need to build roads. If there's somebody out here who builds roads, you're probably saying this guy's an idiot. But for the sake of argument, I think this is probably a reasonably plausible scenario.
You are tuned to the one and only CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's Co-op Radio. The topic is peak oil and climate change, two sides of the same coin, or competing crises. The speaker is Bryn Davidson. Find the slides for this speech at dynamiccities.org.
So if we look at that, the impact is then, what's the average age? Today, our roads are on average 17 years old. In 2040, let's say on average they're 24 years old because we can't repair them as much as we used to. If we look at a distribution today, there's a handful of roads that are older than 30 years and basically beyond service. In this scenario, 2040, a full third of our roads are too old to really probably drive trucks on or buses or other types of things. So I'm going to say that in terms of looking at our infrastructure, we need to stop building new roads and start looking at more of a triage strategy where we say, okay, let's prioritize the roads that carry goods, people, transit, and let's make these our priority for repair and replacement. The highway network, let's do that next. Residential roads, I think a lot of these are going to have to get let go to pot. And of course, priority zero, no net increase to regional road capacity. Now, from this, I'd say, okay, let's make this work for our cities. Let's take a third of our roads and say instead of spending money repairing them, let's naturalize them. St. George Street in Vancouver, it's got a big storm sewer running underneath. Let's daylight that, create creek or habitat or something where, you know, people like to stand around in puddles and pick things up with bags, apparently. So just a bit of a vision, but I think there is a real opportunity to start thinking differently about the public infrastructure that we have in place and the fact that roads, whereas they've always been an economic asset in the past, I think in the future they'll increasingly be seen as liabilities. And so we need to start looking at how we use that public space. We look at a timeline, and on this we have historical oil production, future scenarios. And I'm going to overlay that with my life, my professional career, and my kids, and say that peak oil and climate change are going to define my professional career. They're also going to define the lives of my children, presuming they come along someday. Now, what we look then is, what are we building today that's still going to be here? It's our infrastructure. It's the things, the buildings, the roads, the highways. We're building things today that we're going to be depending on post-peak oil, post-climate change, all of these things. These are the major things that we need to get right. So you don't have to look far to come across a statistic like this one. In 2021, truck traffic is going to rise by 50%. This is off the province's Gateway website. Many of you are familiar with the Gateway Project. I'm completely blown away anytime I see these projections for what's going to happen in 2020 or 2040. People are talking about doubling of container traffic from China, about road capacity, about all of these things that are these extrapolations of what's happened in the past. Frankly, I think they're pure fantasy, but there isn't yet the sort of body of knowledge there to convince people otherwise. So I guess what I'm trying to create in a small way is a first step towards that. So current trends, okay, there's trucks on the current trends. I think that anything that we're building that's going to last beyond 2012 or 2015, we need to use scenario-based planning. You know, we can't just say it's going to keep on going forever. Let's actually look at an oil-constrained future and a carbon-constrained future and talk about what that world is like and what do we actually need to invest in. So truck miles, they're saying plus 50%. I'd argue that we're probably actually going to be somewhere between 10 and 30% down on where we are today in 2020. So the question is road capacity the best way to spend $1 billion? $5 billion, a gazillion, people are doing this all around the world. So there's a whole lot of money being put into this infrastructure. The next thing I say, okay, let's go back and look at those car miles that are being shifted to other modes. So potentially somewhere between 20 and 50% of the people that are driving around today in 2040 are doing something else. They're either not driving, they're taking the bus, they're carpooling, they're riding their bike. That's a whole lot of people that needs a whole lot of infrastructure. So on one hand, I think that whoever's the private concessionaire for the Gateway project, I don't think it's a very good fiscal project when you look at the actual returns over the lifetime of that contract. But I think it's just, it's almost criminal to think about everything that needs to be done, all the money that needs to be spent, and the fact that we would then put it into highway expansion. And I think that really this is one of the scariest things when I look at peak oil and climate change, is the fact that there's so much that needs to be done, but we're throwing billions of dollars into expanding systems that we won't ever need, that will become liabilities in the future and will suck away future resources. So, I mean, I think many people in this room have voiced their opinion at one point or another, but I think anybody who's involved in an infrastructure project needs to hear from people who think that that's a bad idea. This is an interesting book, if anybody hasn't read it yet, just in terms of talking about the types of things that we need to do to reach an aggressive emissions target. I think this quote was interesting just because in the public media, at least, people often say it's economy versus climate. If we address climate change, we're going to destroy the economy. From my point of view, peak oil is the real threat to the economy. It's unavoidable. It's coming. I believe it's here now. Any significant action we take on climate change helps us. Climate change action can save the economy. It's not going to be the thing that destroys it. So I think when we talk about integrating peak oil and climate change, I think that's perhaps one of the most important things to take away from the overall discussion. Peak oil, it's inevitable, it's economic, it's going to affect you fiscally whether or not you believe in climate change. Climate change solutions, the right ones, save you, not save you, but they're the things that are going to help you create the post-carbon economy. They're the things that are going to make your region competitive, your business competitive, and make it a great place to live. I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I think there will be a real drive to open up new land for drilling. And so some of these things are going to be seen as an effort on the part of big business. I think, you know, in Alaska we had Anwar. I don't see any way that we're eventually going to avoid them drilling in Anwar. The question is, can we do the right things everywhere else? The market's a fantastic tool for bringing about innovation. It cares nothing for social justice. So when we're looking about the way these things unfold, the market is a tool. It doesn't look into the future. It reacts. We need market-based solutions, but we also need strong policy. Most of the impacts in terms of climate change, peak oil, will be felt locally. This really needs to be a municipal and regional issue. It's not something that we can leave to the feds. I believe that more and more the impacts of peak oil really will start to outpace our immediate impacts from climate change. But we need to have climate change on the forefront of our minds at all time. And so this is sort of how I cluster it, saying things that are in the middle. We need to invest in things that reduce our emissions and reduce our oil dependence. Now this is where I just sort of jump out of the analytical mode and give my little 5 minutes of promo, because I've got you here as a captive audience. This is a project I'm working on in Alaska. This is a residential addition, suburban project. It's hard to think of a suburban project ever being green. Tried to convince the client that she really didn't need a bigger house, but she was adamant. So what we looked at was, can we actually create a net positive project? So what we're doing, this is the addition. We're doing it to a very high energy standard, and we're also putting additional insulation around the remainder of the house. The idea is that even though we're adding space, the house at the end of this project is going to use less energy and have fewer emissions than it did before. This is a heat recovery ventilator. It takes heat out of the exhaust air and puts it into the incoming air, so you can have fresh air without losing the energy, without just blowing out the smokestack. These are high-performance, triple-glazed, fiberglass frame windows. Fantastic. You can stand right next to them. You don't feel a chill. We're getting more passive solar gain. Again, you can see the exterior insulation. Another project I'm working on is a development project. Again, this is a farm outside of Collingwood, Ontario. Again, you think, okay, this is terrible. And that was kind of my approach to a certain extent. How can we do a green project doing greenfield development on a farm? What we got into was starting to say, okay, let's actually preserve the farm. Let's expand it. We'll convert it to organic agriculture. We'll see if we can get any benefit out of the residential component. We'll put in a public trailhead, have a learning center. People can walk through the farm, learn about farming, all these types of things where we're trying to get a net positive benefit out of the development project. This is sort of a schematic concept of that at the moment. Sort of reed bed for treating the wastewater, public trailhead. People can walk through the organic farm, and then the homes. This is a system diagram for that. We're going to put in a big chunk of solar. We can do that because in Ontario, you can sell solar back to the province for 42 cents a kilowatt. The economics matter. So they're setting up an economic system that makes sense to invest in solar. I think in BC, we could learn a thing or two from that. Our cheap energy isn't helping us invest in the appropriate things, I don't think. So net zero homes, we're going to put in enough solar to try and offset the emissions from construction, offset the emissions from our flights to and from and from driving, and then go 10% beyond that. So that, in theory, after our project's built, the region will actually emit less CO2. High-performance homes, we bundle all of the kind of additional services into one thing. We retain ownership of that. And then we just rent it back to them, kind of like a utility. That way, the person who lives there for the first 3 years doesn't have to pay for it all up front. It's a way of making these green systems attainable and having an ongoing revenue stream. The wastewater treatment, we're capturing all of that wastewater. It's going to hopefully go back into the farm. Water's an issue there, so if we have 9 wells contributing to the farm and it all is part of a closed-loop cycle. And we're also looking at, can we capture the heat out of the wastes and use it in the greenhouses? I'm not quite sure about the scale of that, but that's our aim at the moment. So again, projects, Pico Oil climate change will leave you with happy people in fields, because, again, who doesn't like to be a happy person in the field? That's it. Thanks for listening to us.
That was designer Bryn Davidson speaking at the Vancouver Public Library on December 11, 2007. His topic was on many people's minds, peak oil and climate change, two sides of the same coin or competing crises. Bryn had a series of great slides, which you can view or download free from his website at dynamiccities.org. Click on the Slides and Presentations button to find some of the latest information on world energy production and consumption. If you care about what happens at the gas pump or for your home heating, you might want to find out more from dynamiccities.org. Bryn also has some interesting ways of design for energy-efficient houses and cities. This talk was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. You can download the full speech free from ecoshock.org in the Energy Files. Join us every Tuesday at noon for the best of Vancouver speeches right here on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio. Or listen on the net at www.cooperadio.org.